Hi, I'm Margot Martindale, the host of Foreign Policy's new podcast, I Spy. Spies don't talk. It's one of the rules of the business. But here at Foreign Policy, we get them to open up. Each week, one former operative from somewhere around the world tells the story of one dramatic mission. Subscribe to I Spy wherever you get your podcasts.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, an American in Mosul. Islamic State fighters captured the northern Iraqi city of Mosul at the height of the group's power in 2014. Thousands died in the fighting, and hundreds of thousands of civilians fled the city.
In Mosul today, we saw sporadic gunfire and burning military vehicles. The insurgents seized police stations, banks, and government buildings. Many Iraqi soldiers dropped their weapons and vanished.
2 years later, an international coalition led by Iraqi forces embarked on a campaign to retake Mosul.
The terrorist group showed it was not going down without a fight. This suicide truck bomber careened into a line of Iraqi tanks, then exploded. Giant flames shooting towards the sky.
The journalist Mike Giglio was embedded with the Iraqi Special Operations Forces who entered the city. In his new book, Shatter the Nations, ISIS and the War for the Caliphate, Giglio recounts the battle for Mosul and describes the soldiers and civilians he met along the way. He's our guest this week. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the ICTF. What does it stand for?
Iraqi Counterterrorism Force. They are the lead unit of the Iraqi Special Operations Forces. And so they are really the most elite battalion of soldiers in Iraq. And the reason that they're so special actually is because they have been fighting in one way or another with and for the U.S. for more than a decade. So the battalion was founded in 2005 during the Iraq War because U.S. troops realized that if they were going to really roll up al-Qaeda networks and militia networks, they needed locals to help them. It was almost a lifeline for U.S. forces to say, hey, we need help here. This is chaos. And they stood up this unit to do sensitive missions with U.S. special forces and special operators.
So the U.S. trained them?
They trained them. More importantly than that, though, they spent years working right alongside them.
What happened to this unit in 2011 when the U.S. decided to start drawing down troops?
So by 2011, this unit was really humming, doing the kind of missions that they were trained for. So if you think of them in a UX context, they're somewhat equivalent to SEAL Team 6 or the Delta Force. So they are a highly specialized unit that is trained to conduct missions with a lot of planning and a lot of intelligence against high-value targets, and also to do hostage rescues and things of that nature. So in 2011, that's the kind of work they were doing. They had come through the darkest days of the Iraq War and the surge against al-Qaeda, and they had been so involved in those U.S. efforts that they were really considered one of the elite forces in the Middle East. And so they were hoping to settle into really focus on sensitive missions and high-value targets and sort of conduct missions at the top level to really get the most for their effort. But what happened when the ISIS emergency hit Iraq was they were the last line of defense as the Iraqi military crumbled. And so they went from these specialized missions and this careful planning and training to street fighting. And so some of these soldiers who've been more than a decade alongside U.S. troops with elite training and had survived all through the Iraq War were all of a sudden dying 5-10 at a time in car bombs and IED attacks just as regular soldiers. But there was really no one else to hold the line at that point.
Who are they? Where are they drawn from? What's their population?
They are Iraqi Shia, for the most part, which is the majority of the population in Iraq. The initial U.S. vision for the unit had been for it to be multi-sectarian and multi-ethnic. They have had a Kurdish component historically. After 2011, the U.S. left behind a very sectarian-minded government in Iraq. And that government succeeded in purging a lot of the Sunni members and the Kurdish members from this battalion. like it did from the rest of the Iraqi security forces. But I found that even despite this, maintained the U.S. vision for Iraq more than any other force, which was as an inclusive, multi-sectarian, and multi-ethnic country. So they tended to be predominantly Shia, but they believed in inclusiveness, and they believed that their mission was to protect all Iraqis, and that really did make them unique as a force at the time of the ISIS emergency.
And when you say the ISIS emergency, when are we talking about?
I'm talking about in 2014. The idea when the U.S. left was that the local forces would keep the pressure on AQI, but they weren't really able to successfully do that because of corruption and in the Iraqi military and security forces and because of the sectarianism of the government. And so what you saw was ISIS gradually making a comeback in Iraqi cities, mostly in the shadows initially. So they would conduct assassinations. They would gather intelligence on their security forces as a way to intimidate them and coerce them. And then with the conflict across the border in Syria, AQI sent elements into that conflict to use it to gather strength. And so in 2014, AQI elements, which became ISIS, had already sort of taken control of some of their former strongholds in Iraq. But really the big moment came in June of 2014 when ISIS boomeranged back across the border from Syria and took the Iraqi city of Mosul, which is the Sunni capital of the country and this major city that has a population around the size of Phoenix. When they did that, ISIS, I think, was even surprised at how quickly the regular Iraqi military collapsed. I mean, I talked to soldiers at the time. I was in Baghdad right after it happened, who admitted to tearing off their uniforms and just running, even though they had the numbers, even though they had U.S. weapons. And ISIS all of a sudden was on the gates of Baghdad. Right after Mosul fell, I flew to Baghdad from Istanbul, where I lived, just to give you a sense of what it was like then. Before I got on the plane, I called the former Iraqi ambassador to the U.S., and I said, I'll be in Mosul, in Baghdad tomorrow, and hopefully, if you have any contacts there for me, I'd appreciate it. And he just said, if it's still there.
Oh.
And there really was a sense that Baghdad could be next.
Who were you working for at the time?
I was a staff correspondent for BuzzFeed at the time,
okay. Based
in Istanbul. And when I got on the flight in Istanbul to go to Baghdad, there was actually a news crew filming me because I was the only person getting on the plane. And I sat down on this 300-something seat airline as the only passenger and had this sort of surreal experience where the flight attendant walked up to me and started giving the security demonstration as we're taking off. And then I guess she found it ridiculous, and she just sort of laughed at me and walked away.
So was this your first time in Baghdad?
It was my first time in Baghdad. And actually, you know, for me as a young journalist who was really driven to cover war, I was inspired actually by the Iraq War, which took place when I was just starting college. And so for me to land in Baghdad and sort of see the panic and the chaos from this new conflict, but also the signs all around the city of the past one, you know, the security cordons, the blast walls around even civilian neighborhoods, the real just tense, walled off, like prison yard claustrophobia of the city was really moving to me. And I remember walking around the city and noticing that there were just lines stretched out from all the travel agencies. And I learned later that the only reason that ISIS didn't advance all the way to Baghdad, and who knows how far they could have gone, was because the Iraqi Special Operations Forces and this battalion that I embedded with had abandoned their normal counterterrorism mission and just filled out the lines as frontline fighters and were really just taking massive amounts of casualties in the process.
And when did you meet them?
I met them much later, in 2016. So by that point, I had been covering ISIS and the war against ISIS for more than 2 years. And I viewed the signature battle for ISIS territory and of the war, really, that the U.S. had entered at that point as the battle for Mosul, the place where ISIS had shocked the world, the place where it had declared its territory as a caliphate, which, of course, is a travesty for Muslims, but the way that they sought to portray themselves internationally and draw recruits. And I was trying to find a way to cover it that would put me really close to the fighting. And I arrived in Baghdad that fall, weeks ahead of the offensive, and sought out the ICTF because I'd received a tip that these were the soldiers that not just were going to play a key role in the battle, but that would actually be the tip of the spear. So they would, you know, be the first into ISIS territory where they could.
So set the scene for me. This is now you're back in Baghdad. It's a couple weeks before the offensive to take Mosul back. How did it differ from that first time you were there with that ISIS panic around you?
There was a sense this time of momentum, tenuous. The city had been really devastated by ISIS attacks and car bombs. And so there was that sense of sort of wariness and really like a depression, you know, that comes in a city that's just under assault. And at any point, you know, civilians might get killed in a car bomb or something like that. But at the same time, there was the feeling that at least the signature battle is coming. And you could feel that sort of momentum. So this is October of 2016. The U.S. presidential election is coming up. And ISIS, by this point, had been committing terrorist attacks across Europe and had inspired terrorist attacks in America. And populists were using that in all the Western countries to sort of gather momentum themselves and to demonize Muslims more generally and to demonize refugees. And it really felt like the world was sort of at this breaking point. And maybe if the soldiers could stop ISIS in the heart of its territory, it could put an end to this sort of upheaval that was kind of reverberating out throughout the rest of the world. And I was really surprised by the way the soldiers spoke of the battle in those terms. So
almost existential.
Yeah, like, this is a battle for our neighborhoods. This is a battle for Iraq. This is not a war of choice for us. This has come to our homes. And so they were there for that reason, their own individual reasons. But they also said time and again, you know, we are the world's front line against ISIS.
How did you go about embedding with them?
I showed up in Baghdad with a photographer who had worked with them once before. And we really just started, I mean, in like the journalistic fashion of forcing your way into a situation, just hassling them, calling them, asking for coffee, asking to meet, and made our case why they should bring us with them. You know, the kind of embed that we wanted to do was different than the way journalists, including myself, sometimes cover a battle where you go to what you consider to be a front line, but it's really set back from like the actual fighting, and it's like the nearest secure place that you can go. What we wanted to do was actually embed with them while they were fighting. And so we were making a really big ask of the commander to say, we want you to let us travel in your convoys into Mosul, and we want you to put us in your Humvees as you are going and driving into ISIS territory. And they didn't agree to it right away.
Were they concerned that they'd have to protect you and that you'd be a hassle?
They're concerned that they have to protect you. They're also concerned that they don't have the space in their Humvees. Mm-hmm. Each Humvee has maximum 4 or 5 people, soldiers. Each of them has a job to do. So to remove two of them and put in 2 journalists is actually a risk to them. So what we did at first was say, hey, just let us travel with you from Baghdad to the edge of Mosul while you get ready. And so when they actually opened up their battle for Mosul, we were in the first attacking column of Humvees that pushed into ISIS territory.
What was the sense among the ICTF at that point? What was the feeling towards Americans?
They have a very, I would say, uniquely positive view of the U.S. just by nature of their history with American forces. So I was really struck by even the way they look and talk. Some of them wear skull masks into battle. They're really a very striking group of soldiers. So they dress all in black. Their Humvees are black. They go into battle with bulldozers that are armored and black. They travel in up to these front lines in buses that are painted black. Every last thing with them is black. And then they wear like these Punisher skull masks when they're fighting. But they also wear baseball caps and wraparound Oakleys, looking exactly like American Special Forces do in the field. And they use words like bro and dude and kind of this American soldier style of talking. And they, you know, because they've spent so much time working with Americans, they tend to view the U.S. military favorably. And also they sort of take America warts and all. Mm-hmm. So they know America has made, I mean, in Iraq more than anywhere else, tons of mistakes and is responsible for so much of the suffering there. But they also seem to feel that America is well-intentioned. And, you know, there's a scene in the book where I meet an Iraqi soldier from the ICTF as I'm trying to arrange this embed and we have dinner. And I'm talking to him, and I realize that we're the same age. And, you know, when the Iraq War started, I was a freshman in college, so fighting age. That sort of went about my own life as if it wasn't really my problem. I kind of think of it as, what was my attitude to the war back when I was younger? Maybe like a baseball game on mute in the background of my life, where I root for the home team, but I think that that's the extent of what my country really asks of me. And I don't think that my lesson on that is, oh, I should have joined the military. I think it's, I should have been politically engaged in some way. I should have really been paying attention. But I think because America has a volunteer military, we are encouraged not to feel ownership of our own military adventures overseas. And I feel like that sense of detachment from our own wars was really exacerbated by the war with ISIS, in which Americans were told, not only do we not have a draft and we have a volunteer army, but American soldiers aren't really that involved. We're just doing these airstrikes. We're at war with ISIS, but you don't have to worry about it. You know, we didn't bother as a country to really get to know who was making the sacrifice on our behalf, on their behalf and on our behalf. And that was the local soldiers in Iraq and in Syria, which is a big focus of the book. And I also think it meant that Americans didn't make an effort to really get to know the enemy either. And so I think ISIS is often portrayed in the press as sort of like stormtroopers from Star Wars. Like, they just march forward on their evil mission. They don't have any agency, and they're just kind of almost robotic. I really made an effort to try to understand who they were and to meet them as they were living and working.
Okay, so take us to Mosul. You're on the outskirts of Mosul. How are the soldiers preparing themselves?
So by the time I arrived to the outskirts of Mosul with the ICTF, they had been leading this fight against ISIS for more than 2 years. And they were really beaten down by the pace of the battle and by the casualties that they were taking. I remember when I met the soldiers that I was going to be accompanying into battle, I was sort of shocked to see what they looked like. Like, I have this image of a soldier in my mind's eye, really fit, chiseled. These guys are not that at all. Some of them are just really skinny. There's no muscles on their frame. Some of them are fat. Some are very old. Some of them have gray or white hair. They have these scars all over them. And I realized as I got to know them that it's because they were just consumed for so long with fighting. No time for personal training, no time for physical fitness, just day after day and month after month of fighting.
So entering Mosul, what's the biggest risk?
Car bombs.
Tell us about the car bombs.
So the unit, the ICTF, pushes into ISIS territory in armored Humvees. So these are big, hulking vehicles with plated armor all around them that can mostly withstand gunfire. So the bullets just ping off. Or if they hit the windows, hopefully they just dent them because they're reinforced. And even a mortar may be able to hit the Humvee and not kill the people inside of it. For instance, I was in a Humvee that was hit by a grenade. So terrible sound, really deafening because you're inside a metal shell getting hit with an explosive. But we all survived. The thing that they can't defend against is car bombs. And if you think about the main weapon for each side, the ICTF and the other units in Iraq, their main strength is the U.S. airstrikes that are backing them up. ISIS sought to have its own firepower in these car bombs, which, you know, a car bomb can just be a regular car sort of rigged up with explosives left by an intersection or even driven by someone into a target. But these car bombs that ISIS was making were much more powerful than that, and they were up armored. So they were making them in factories and putting sheets of armor on them. So they were like mini versions of the Humvee, and they would have they were just clattering as they sped toward the Humvees. And it really had this sort of Mad Max dystopian feel, where it was both sides just charging at one another in these metal war machines. And I was shocked throughout the offensive by just how many car bombs there were. I could never imagine how ISIS could convince so many people to pilot these vehicles and detonate themselves. But they came one after another throughout the entire offensive for months. The main experience for me of a car bomb is listening for the word car bomb on the radio. So as you're driving through these ISIS-held areas, there's always a military radio in the background where the commander is just speaking and they're yelling at each other and, you know, giving updates on what they see. And I became very attuned to the Arabic words for car bomb. And all of a sudden someone starts yelling it on the radio and everyone just starts scanning where is it coming from, because often they don't see where it's coming from. And if you see the car bomb, it could be too late, right? You don't want to see it. You want to hope that a tank or a U.S. airstrike hits it before it gets too close to you. But there was one instance where a car bomb passed all of our defenses and was about 20 yards from us and chasing us. And so in that case, what we see is just our own mad effort to get away from it. And we see the car bomb kind of closing on us through our reinforced windshields.
Tell me about seeing civilians. Here you are in Mosul. ISIS took Mosul 2 years before you arrive. It's now 2016. Have these civilians been fully cut off for 2 years from the world?
I remember driving through Mosul in a Humvee and noticing graffiti written on every wall in one neighborhood, every exterior wall of the houses. And it said clear or something to that effect. And it meant that ISIS had taken away all the communications equipment and satellite from that family. And they really did what they could to cut off access for residents to the rest of the world. And even as the offensive was closing in on ISIS areas, they were telling residents that everything was fine. You know, ISIS did everything it could to keep civilians in its territory. I was often really dismayed to come home, you know, once a year or twice a year and talk with people in America and hear the question, well, if people still live in ISIS territory, they must in some way support ISIS. And I would say, you know, no, they're really hostages. If people tried to leave ISIS territory, oftentimes they would be killed. ISIS instilled such a fear in the people that lived under its control. And I understand why people ask that question, but if you ever sat with someone who did escape ISIS territory and you walk through this, what went through in their own mind as they made that consideration, it's not just, can I get out or can I get my immediate family out? It's, what happens to my brother and his family? What happens to my cousin? Do they all now get put on an ISIS list? What happens to my neighbors? They had to kind of make this kind of horrible calculations. So basically what would happen is the battalion would push into a new neighborhood. The fighting in that neighborhood would be chaotic, and it would offer space for civilians to flee. And so people would just come rushing out of these neighborhoods like one after another. It would be like an exodus.
And you're talking about children?
Children.
Older people?
Older people, families. I remember a little girl screaming and running with her mother as mortars were flying overhead and making this whooshing sound. I remember a little kid in the same procession with a school backpack on, just skipping down the street. I remember a woman in big designer sunglasses and an abaya, you know, dressed as if she were going to the, you know, any of the designer malls in Istanbul or New York. It really was just a mix of the city. And Mosul was an international city as far as they were concerned. It was a place with a beautiful university that had international connections and very educated people in it. And these were the people that were fleeing years of totalitarian ISIS control. And I would stand with my photographer in the middle of the street, and, you know, if it looked like someone was willing to speak, to pull them aside and talk to them. You know, they would ask me, is it safe here? Like, they didn't know, you know, whether they were finally out of harm's way. Like, almost they couldn't believe that they might finally be in the clear. And in this procession, you'd see, I remember a woman pushing in a donkey cart, suffering from shrapnel wounds, while a little girl sat right next to her, a boy with shrapnel in his chest. I mean, it was, you know, as soon as ISIS lost control of their neighborhood, they started pounding it with mortars and car bombs. It was just really scorched earth.
What did the buildings look like? Were you seeing destruction everywhere?
Yeah. The destruction was twofold. It was from the fighting, and it was from the U.S. airstrikes. And some areas were just pulverized. And I was very concerned about civilian casualties from U.S. airstrikes. And how can I see how this battle is actually playing out? And, you know, as you know, like, the farther you get from a war, the harder it is to figure out what's happening. And because we're so up close into the fighting with these guys and doing it for so long, like, I do believe that eventually they're not putting on an act for a reporter anymore. Like, they're really just trying to survive. And even as chaotic as it got in the battle, this unit at least took real care to minimize civilian casualties. Even with that, I mean, there were civilian casualties everywhere. And I made a real effort to go back later and document instances where the U.S. had killed civilians. And I did it at random. I went into Eastern Mosul after it had been taken back from ISIS, I would go to like a deli or a fruit stand, and I would ask people if they knew of anyone where any places where civilians had been killed in U.S. airstrikes. And inevitably, they would say, sure, and take me down the street, and they'd say, this house right here, which is in rubble, this was an ISIS house. These were ISIS members who were killed. But this house here, this one had a family in it. And usually there was a relative or someone who had survived the strike nearby, and they would call the person, and they would come and give me an account of what had happened. And I can only spend 25 minutes in a site like this because we were really concerned that we did it without a military embed, because I didn't want to influence the investigation by being there with the guys with the guns.
You've jumped ahead a tiny bit, though. At what point did you feel like the tide was turning and ICTF was going to take Mosul back?
Really, actually, on election night.
2016.
Yeah, 2016. We had been with the ICTF in the first neighborhood of eastern Mosul for a couple of days. So we were technically in Mosul, and as I expected, the ICTF, they were the first soldiers to step foot in Mosul in more than 2 years. And the commander, the night of the election, brought us deeper into the city, into like a central neighborhood of eastern Mosul. And I remember with my photographer crawling up to the roof and looking out over the edge and being told that in the morning we'd be able to see the Tigris River, which splits the city in half. And I really felt like, okay, hey, we're finally, after all this, we're finally here. And it really felt odd to wake up in Mosul. So that night I slept in a civilian home that had been commandeered by the ICTF in a closet. And so I woke up at 6 a.m. and there were mortars hitting outside. So I kind of just like woke up, and there was like children's stuffed animals around me, because in the closet and like a toolbox, the signs of the family that had lived there. I checked the Twitter on my phone and saw the, you know, Trump was winning the election. And it just felt strange to think, you know, now that this battle is finally changing to the Iraqi side, you know, back at home, the same person who had done so much to raise fears about ISIS was actually succeeding in his political efforts.
On your last trip into the region to Mosul, during that offensive, was there a sense of triumph? Was there a sense of success?
So my last trip to Mosul was in May of 2017, and that was the trip where I went to document civilian casualties. It was a sense of just, this has gotten way uglier than anyone intended. So the battle for eastern Mosul came first. That was the last battle of the Obama administration. The battle for western Mosul was the first battle of the Trump administration. And there are a lot of reasons why the Battle of Western Mosul was much bloodier. It's more concentrated terrain. ISIS pulled its forces back continually until they were just in Western Mosul. It was like where they made their last stand. And traditionally, it has had more support for AQI and for ISIS. So it was always going to be a harder fight there. But Trump also, when he came into office, loosened the rules on U.S. airstrikes that had been intended to reduce civilian casualties. All these things combined, it made Western Mosul just a picture of destruction. So by comparison's sake, in Eastern Mosul, there was destruction, as I mentioned, but it was here and there. There were plenty of parts of that half of the city still standing. And because of that, residents were able to return fairly quickly, and life was able to resume fairly quickly. So I returned to Eastern Mosul after it was, you know, only a few months freed from ISIS, and people were painting. They were clearing rubble from the streets. The markets were full of fruit, and you know, like they were. It was defiant, but it was returned to life. Western Mosul was just a hellscape. It was just entire blocks destroyed. You know, there was an account from a local journalist this week. 2 years after Iraq declared victory over ISIS, they are still pulling bodies from the rubble in Western Mosul. I don't think anyone's thought this is the kind of lasting, triumphant victory that we had in mind. And I know the ICTF, like I said, they had taken such care to avoid civilian casualties, and they were so clear with me throughout, we would have to rebuild this. We're trying to win over the population here. And in the East, they succeeded. By the time they got to Western Mosul, it's worth noting, you know, when I list all these reasons why it was just so much more destructive there, they were so weakened that the Iraqi special forces more generally were just part of the equation in Western Mosul. So in Eastern Mosul, they were the entire show. They did all the fighting in that part of the offensive. In Western Mosul, they played one role, but the Iraqi Federal Police, the Iraqi military, other units from the Interior Ministry all played a much bigger role, and they had much less regard for civilian casualties. So it all kind of broke down into really just a very, very sad picture.
How do you carry it yourself?
I was a willing participant in this, and I had always the ability to come in and out and to leave. And, you know, I try to remain grateful that these people, whether it be the battalion or the civilians that I spoke to, were willing to host me there and to open up on what they were experiencing and to sort of be willing to at least support the mission of sharing that, you know, through my journalism and through my writing. So I try and keep that in mind. Like,
but as a new father now, congratulations, and knowing how many of these men are fathers and women, although I think most of the fighters you were with were men, how do you perceive the loss and the sense of what you saw at this point in your life?
I have a story that I can't get out of my head that sort of captures how I feel, but also makes me wonder if I could have done this if I had already had a child. When I was investigating civilian casualties, I learned that there was a man who he briefly left his house one morning to go and get gas for the family's generator. And when he left, a U.S. airstrike hit the house and it killed his wife and his three daughters. And while I was at the side of the house, I interviewed his neighbors, and they told me that he would come a few times a week to the site of his house, of the airstrike, and just sort of like dig through the rubble with his hands. And then he would sit down and start crying and then ultimately just walk away. And so I called him and I asked him what he was doing when he was digging through the rubble. And he told me that he himself had managed to find the pieces of his wife and daughters. And yeah. And that he'd bury them himself, you know? And he couldn't find part of one of his daughters. And so he wanted like that closure before he would finally leave Mosul. And you think like, you know, why isn't anyone helping this guy? You know, all he told me, all I want is help to find my daughter, and then I'm gonna leave. And it really kind of brought home for me, you know, I make such an effort to kind of make Americans feel like, and make myself feel like we are responsible in some way for these places that we fight wars. The U.S. government made no effort to contact him. They ultimately, based on my evidence that I gathered while I was there, they admitted to the strike. They admitted we killed his family by accident. They made no effort to reach him. They offered him no condolence payment, even though there are congressional funds set aside for this. And not even help to dig through the rubble. And, you know, so when I say bodies are still being pulled from the rubble, it's, you know, for me, it's like that's part of America's responsibility, you know. And that's a little tiny picture of how bad a job we as a country do in following up and trying to really leave these places with some measure of closure and stability after the fighting is done.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Mike Giglio. Now a staff writer at The Atlantic, Giglio wrote his new book, Shatter the Nations, ISIS and the War for the Caliphate, largely based off his reporting for BuzzFeed. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Benjamin Soloway, Anise Modi, and Orly Wildman-Halpern. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, hit subscribe on your podcast app. Then come back next week. We'll have a new episode.
Hi, I'm Margo Martindale, the host of Foreign Policy's new podcast, I Spy. Spies don't talk. It's one of the rules of the business. But here at Foreign Policy, we get them to open up. Each week, one former operative from somewhere around the world tells the story of one dramatic mission. Subscribe to iSpy wherever you get your podcasts.